is time to dive into this, our last session of Making Christian Sense of Contemporary Popular Music. Thank you all for coming out on a Saturday morning. I hope that this last conversation leaves us on a positive note. In the course of the week, we've dealt with various kinds of music that have put before us various kinds of challenges. And what I wanted to do in this final session, it's in many ways the most sort of far-ranging, kind of free-flowing session of the bunch. All I want to do here is put before us three songs by three artists, well, really four. One is kind of a collaborative effort. But put before you three songs that have nothing in common in terms of their sort of stylistic origins, in terms of the artists who created them, the styles they are born of, the genres, except the fact that they appear to set out to uplift. That these are songs that survey the fallen condition in which we dwell, and to say there is a way out of this, that there is grounds for hope, that there is the possibility of something like rebirth. And I think that's about all I want to offer by way of introduction. I think the best thing to do is probably to dive in to these things. And to ask in part, do we believe these stories? Do we believe pop artists? What is it that would or would not give us confidence in a pop artist who somehow is claiming to have the authority, to have the knowledge, to say, you know, there is grounds for hope, keep your eyes on the prize and hope for better things. And so this is the kind of issue that we'll be living with as we make our way through these pieces. By what authority do these artists speak? On what grounds do we find their claims to the possibility of rebirth credible, or the possibility of genuine hope in the face of despair? Obviously, there's a feeling here of coming full circle. If you've been with me from the beginning of the week, you will be aware that our first conversation on Monday was about redemption, about Bruce Springsteen and his way of in Boston. And there are ways of arguing for redemption, for something like rebirth. In a sense, we are seeking to come full circle here, but on very different stylistic grounds. The first song that you have before you, the lyrics are long enough, they take both sides of this piece of paper. It is by a rap artist named Twista and an R&B artist named Faith Evans. Faith is going to be doing nothing but singing here. Twista is going to be doing nothing but rapping. That's what they're both known for, and they have just converged here on this song, which in essence is comprised of rapped verses and sung choruses. We've not had a chance to say anything about rap in the course of this week thus far, and I suspect that many of you may not have listened to a whole lot of rap in your lives. Some of us will have a serious investment in the stuff, and some of us will not. I, for example, do. There are certain rap artists that I'm extremely fond of. And I guess I would just suggest that whether we like this genre of music or not, that is whether we feel like our ears are instantly drawn into it, that we're, you know, instantly compelled by it, nourished by it, and so on, there's a major segment of the U.S. population, and increasingly the global population, for whom this seems to be the lingua franca. This is the musical language God has given them, that their predecessors have given them. The question just becomes, are those of us who did not grow up in environments in which rap was the musical lingua franca, we have the privilege of choosing either to listen or not. I think that if we opt to listen, it will be songs like this that probably make us feel more fully invited into the conversation than any others. This is, to me, a very inviting song, a very difficult song in my mind not to like at some level. There are people referred to that we will not all be familiar with, and I wanted to sort of point out a couple of things as we make our way along. And in a sense, even pointing these out is to cite something about the trajectory of this song and its rhetoric. In this big, long first verse, we get references to my brother, to my grandmother. I wish my grandmother wasn't sick. Wish my homie Butch was still alive. These, as far as I can tell, are not public figures that we're talking about. We don't know the state of Twista's grandmother. We don't know who Butch is, his friend Butch, that he makes reference to. In the second verse, this begins to change. When he speaks, for example, about seven lines from the bottom of this first page, of seeing the vision of the world through the eyes of Stevie Wonder. Of course, Stevie Wonder is one of the most important rhythm and blues artists, well, of all time, but through the 70s, you know, probably his heyday, he is blind. And this is a sort of Miltonian gesture here, speaking of seeing the world through his eyes. As we turn the page over, we get into more topical reference points. I wish that D.O.C. could scream again. D.O.C. is a rapper whose voice was injured in a car wreck in 1990. He'd been involved with N.W.A., with Dr. Dre's sort of crew in the Los Angeles area, but his voice was damaged in a car wreck. He continues to make music, but his voice, which was very distinctive, has been completely altered. That bullets could reverse, so Pac and Biggie breathe again. Well, Pac and Biggie are, of course, Tupac Shakur, who died in 1996, and the notorious B.I.G., Biggie Smalls, who died the following year. They were both murdered, both shot in sort of rap-related, sort of rap rivalry-looking incidents. They were both 25 years old. When they died, and both really at the top of their game. These are historical subjects we're talking about. And then, of course, by the end of the last verse, we get into the words of Jesus. If you have the faith of a mustard seed, you can move mountains. So it really is as though we're working our way toward the inner sanctum. From these very private stories, my brother, my homie Butch, my grandmother, into public figures, Stevie Wonder, Tupac, Biggie, into Jesus himself. It's as though the world is becoming a grander and grander place. Let's give this song a listen and see what you make of it.
I try to spread my message to the world the best way that I can give it. living. I pray for justice when we go to court. Wish it was all good, so the country never even went to war. Why can't we kick it and just get them on? And in the famous words of Mr. King, why can't we all just get along? Hope we can find a better way to shop and please, and I hope we find a better way to cop our keys, and I wish everybody would just stop and freeze and ask, why are we fulfilling these animals and these prophecies? You can be wrong if it's you down. With the faith of a mustard seed, you can move out. And only the heavenly father can ease the hurt. Just let it go and keep praying on your knees.
Yes, I am hopeful for today. Take this music and use it. Can it take you away? And be hopeful, hopeful.
So here I am at Holden Village playing all the song about selling crack and being chased by the police and shot and all that. What do we make of this song? What do we make of this world and Twista's way, Faith Evans' way of talking his, her way out of it?
I get the impression that, in a foxhole everybody wants God.
You know, whatever. I didn't hear.
In a foxhole.
Oh, yes. Okay. And so you don't find this credible somehow that this is, you know, I believe him if he were talking about being rich and having everything he wanted and still praying, but because we're speaking from such dire straits.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just doubt his sincerity. I don't know that that's true. I wonder.
Why do you wonder?
I mean, what? Because I wonder how he got there to begin with.
Okay. Very good. Very good.
I have a little different twist on it. I am not in this clutter that they're talking about here, in chaos in the lives. And I think what this spoke to me was, even in all of that chaos, regardless of how they got there, there still is a wish for those things that I wish for. World peace, the Martin Luther King promises, those core values that keep us going forward, whatever way that is. And I think that's, I like things like this song, because they speak about another culture, but also accent the values and the beliefs that I think bind us all together. And it's nice to see that shows up in this.
Okay.
Not only just speaks of another culture, which sounds like Ethiopia, but it speaks of a culture right here in America. Children born into poverty, they're born into violence, they don't know any different. And they look around and they see people they care about being shot, selling drugs on the corner, women selling their bodies, and they're hoping that the words of Christ really do apply to them, and that there is hope for them to grow into old age.
Excellent.
It would just popped into my mind were the beat poets of the 50s, Fred getting a social critique that's underneath.
Yeah. Very nice. There's another hand that I missed.
Oh, she just about said, well, to me it's amazing that with a background like this that they can have that much hope to look forward to.
Right. And nobody is born wanting to be a crack dealer. I mean, that is, people are born in situations, people with aspirations, hopes, and dreams exactly like mine. I never faced that temptation. People handed me schools and, a safe place to live and all that, and ways to make money, ways to envision myself as having a future as a participant in a society that wanted me. And if I had grown up without all those things, I'd certainly be facing, or could well be facing, much of what our subject here, our speaker here, is facing. And obviously Twist is assuming a role. He is a top 40, a best-selling musician. The guy's got piles of money. He is not selling crack, being chased by the police. He's assuming a kind of traditional sort of gangster role that exists there in the vocabulary of rap in order to kind of tell a story and perhaps to describe the place he comes from and to work his way into experiences that he's actually having. The extent to which he actually dwells in the world he's describing, this is debatable, but within the world of rap, this is a subject position that is, Peter Holmer, while he was here giving Bible study every morning, talked a great deal about the true. Here we have a story that Jesus tells. Is this story true? It may not be historically true, but it may be true in some other way, in some finally more meaningful way. We have gangster rappers all the time describing lives that they probably aren't leading themselves, but people much like them are, and their friends from home probably are, and so they may be true at a deeper level. How does the song do its work?
I think the other thing is, so much of the rap, I don't listen to any at all, really, but the stuff we hear in the background always seems so angry. It's got an angry tone to it, and this just really doesn't have that.
Right.
This is much more hopeful, and I think that just lovely descending chord progression just sort of softens it, too.
Right. We have the same the same kind of cycle of chords over and over again through these whole thing. I'm trying to think my way through the chorus, but at least through the verses. What does it mean? What do these, we kind of do essentially the same thing three times, then something different. And this is the kind of four-event idea that drives us through every verse. Happened there. We have sort of three times we make our way from here to here. And the fourth time we make our way from here to here. This kind of tears the heart out every time it happens. Why? I mean, what can we say musically? What does that mean? I mean, why are the chords put together that way? What's the effect of those things? Can we talk our way into this? Jazz musician to sort of fill us in. But there's certainly this thing that occurs, that we make our way from this, through the history of, the last 300 years of music, the association has always worked that way. You got something happy to say, major is probably your mode. If you got something sad to say, minor is probably your mode. And so that's right. So three times we fall, and three times we make this descent from through all that. And then we start in a place of minorness, and we make our way up to the major. Isn't that the whole story? I mean, isn't that what this song is trying to tell us? That yes, happiness will always lead to sadness, but look, it might not always work that way. There may be reason to think it'll go differently. Are hoping and wishing the same thing?
Well, you said happiness always leads to sadness, but also sadness, if you have hope, can always lead to happiness. So there's the reverse of that, too.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And speaking of hope, thus the question. The word wish is pronounced 10 times in the first verse. I wish this, I wish this, I wish this, I wish this. Even Faith Evans comes in and sings her beautiful little her little I wish, that we have sung in the middle. And there's a sense in which Faith Evans coming in as a singer in the middle of these raps just to say, I wish. It's as though this whole thing is being sanctified somehow, being elevated to the level of prayer.
To piggyback on that, all those choruses, Kirk Franklin, This, when the chorus came in, I thought it must be him. Exact same modern gospel music.
Yep. Yeah, this is a gospel song. And I mean, I put this forward, and we're all going to walk out of here thinking, well, he played us a rap song. It's only a rap song, North by Northwest. It's a rap song that turns into a gospel song. The choruses are gospel music. They're not rap music. And I mean, this is a wonderful observation. But why is it that in the course of those rapt verses, when all is sort of bleakness, or at least much is bleakness, in the course of those verses, when the world is being confronted, the word, the operative word is wish. And that's the only word that we hear about sort of how we're going to approach the condition that we're in. I wish things were different. But then at the end of every verse, he makes this turn, which sneaks past us so quickly we don't pay much attention. Just say a little prayer, get you money, man. Life goes on. Let's hope. Well, this is a word that he hasn't used before. The word hope hasn't appeared yet. But that turns out to be the word that's at work in the chorus. I'm hopeful, she says. Are wishing and hoping the same thing? What's the relationship between those things? Say it again.
Not necessarily, in my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopeful's more proactive. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hopeful means
yes.
That you make, believe that you can make a difference.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that finally, wishful thinking and hopeful thinking are very different things. I mean, you can sit around saying, boy, I'm poor, I wish I had a pile of money. That doesn't mean much of anything, but to say that you do live in hope that things will be different, well, it is something else.
Yeah. Hopeful means, okay, I can see a path out of here. I'm hopeful that I will get into the right crowds and the right people and the right education and the right job, and I have a little bit of say over what goes over in my life. Wishing is very, it's... There's no involvement in wishing. It's fantasy.
Yeah. Excellent.
You know, in Spanish, the word for hope and to await is the same, whereas wish is something more ethereal.
Yeah.
It seems like.
Excellent.
In Spanish, I didn't hear it. I'm sorry.
The word for wish and, no, the word for hope and to await is the same.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Esperanza.
And if there's anything in the liturgy that makes you want to plunge back into the Greek or the Hebrew or the Latin and figure out what we're really saying when we say we await his coming in glory, then we're going to think, hang on, await. What does that mean exactly? Is that the same as hope? Is that the same as wish? Is that the same as expect? I mean, you just want to sort of dive in there and figure out, what are we saying every Sunday about awaiting his coming in glory? But this is a wonderful observation, that we're not just sort of wishing for more of this, we're awaiting this, perhaps. You know, we expect it. We have some faith in this thing. Now, of course, I'm cheating here, where the whole point of this, this week-long session is concerned. This is obviously a Christian song. I mean, this is not a song in which we have to work hard to sort of tweak out Christian messages. It's a Christian song. And by the time he gets into the end of that last verse, the verse about Jesus, you can be wrong if it's you doubting. With the faith of a mustard seed, you can move mountains. And only the Heavenly Father can ease the hurt. Just let it go and keep praying on your knees in church and let's hope. Obviously this is just a straight-ahead Christian piece of music. It's curious how many, those of us who have not sort of spent time in the rap world, probably have a lot of, with all due respect, probably have a lot of wrong ideas about it. I mean, that is that the popularity of rap, we talked last time about Rick Rubin having supervised Run DMC's recording of Walk This Way. Well, Run DMC are these two guys. Run is Joseph Simmons, that's his stage name, Joseph Simmons. His older brother, Russell Simmons, is the greatest rap impresario in New York. But Joseph and Russell Simmons, this great rap impresario who really brought rap into the mainstream, brought rap to MTV, brought rap into the world, both as record producers, as performers, as show managers. Well, what does their dad do for a living? He's a minister. They grew up in Hollis, Queens, in the house of a minister. And Joseph Simmons is at different points in their lives, it's been clear that these are very God-fearing people. At least Joseph. I don't know about Russell. He seems like kind of a lost sheep. But Joseph, at least, they're serious about this. These are people raised by ministers. That this is an element of rap that we can trace from the very beginning. And Tupac, who, yes, ends up dead at the age of 25 in this kind of dispute, he seems to have been a fairly profoundly spiritual person and a person who very much had his heart in the right place. If you sort of, you know, Google him, find the songs that he wrote about his mother, about sort of family values and things, there have been few more powerful advocates for family values than a figure like Tupac. Although in the world of mainstream America, we think we'll look at that rapper. He messed around with, you know, awful people. He dwelled among the evil, and he died for it. And, you know, this is just a kind of classic rap tale. Well, no. I mean, he was a very life-affirming artist. He had some very powerful messages to provide. The kind of message that Twista is laying out here, these are not rare. I mean, this is one of the central streams of rap music, is the world is very bad. Let's see if we can pull ourselves out with God's help. And this is how it goes. Closing thoughts about this song before we...
How do you define rap?
I define it, for one thing, I use this word rap in a way that few academics are really using it anymore. That hip-hop is an entire culture. Hip-hop, a sort of web of African-American cultural practices. And, of course, the world has now embraced, as it does, everything of consequence musically that the United States has given to the world. From ragtime, jazz, most importantly, rock and roll music, rap, finally, it all has its roots, at least, in African-American music. The only things of global significance that the United States has brought to the world are African-American musical practices. And that really is scarcely overstating the case. But the world is now in the process of confronting the great tradition of hip-hop. And hip-hop involves breakdancing. It involves modes of speech, of sort of spoken word performance that really are not quite the same as rap. It involves kinds of rhythm and blues music. There is much that one hears on R&B stations that really isn't rap at all, though it dwells in the same land. I use the word rap in a very particular technical, sort of musical sense, just to refer to this practice of talking without pitches, which is to say, if you're speaking your way through a song in this sort of rhythmically calculated way without singing, that's what I'm calling rap. And it's just as simple as that. But rap is one, an important phenomenon, but just one phenomenon among the many cultural practices that form hip-hop writ large. Does that answer the question at all?
Yeah, it's spoken so fast. I'm just wondering, does the listener typically know the words? Do they know what the message is? When
the kids do.
Their
ears pick it up quicker than ours do.
Yeah. And this is a very fast rap. Yeah. That's kind of the gimmick of this song, as it is. And there are people for whom that is the gimmick, is this kind of speed rapping. This is certainly not what it all sounds like. And some of the most forceful rap. I mean, if we go back and listen to the stuff that Public Enemy are doing in in the late 80s and so on, what Run DMC are doing in the mid 80s, no, you can hear every word, and it's there's no problem at all sort of soaking up the message. And I'm not trying to sort of sugarcoat this. There's another grand tradition of gangster rap, which is just the most, it does include the most sort of violent sort of moral turpitude that one can possibly imagine, where it's just about nothing but violence and wanton immorality, and this is a role that people can stand up, a persona that people can stand up and sort of embody. And it's not that all rap is, life-affirming and helpful and all that. Much is not. And that music, we can negotiate a relationship too. I mean, that music also has its role, just as nearly all of the most popular music, popular movies that are enjoyed by mainstream America, The Godfather, whatever, brutally violent, savage films. That if we actually had to sort of weigh the moral compass of our children against the movies that they choose to watch, all the war movies, all the gangster movies, all that, the world would be falling apart at the seams, which it certainly isn't. I don't know. Well, let's not go there. The point is that, I mean, you know, as long as the Hollywood film has been around, there have been gangster movies. And gangster movies we, you know, have made our peace with. We understand what a gangster movie looks like. In the same way, there's gangster rap. The gangsters have changed color. The behavior really has not in any sort of systemic ways. The gangster has been with us always. And rap has done its own kind of inflection of it. But whatever. Closing thoughts before we... Let's move on to what may seem more familiar ground to many, to a song that was released in 1998 by Sarah McLachlan, a Canadian artist who in the late 90s, was enjoying her heyday. McLachlan is still around. I have not really followed her career that carefully over the last... I've not followed her career that carefully over the last few years. This song that we're about to hear, Adia, comes from her album, Surfacing. And with Surfacing, she really did just kind of find herself queen of the pop world. The album sold extremely well. This was, we don't need to tell the whole history, but suffice to say, she had a mammoth following. I sort of groped around for ways to talk about Bruce Springsteen and Bruce Springsteen's significance for a real Springsteen fan. It's a difficult thing to talk about, just how, just what Bruce Springsteen seemed to embody for many of his fans. But he was more than a pop star. He was more than an entertainer. And you can't walk up to a basic New Jerseyite and say, I do like that entertainer, Bruce Springsteen. He's not an entertainer in the eyes of many. He's something more than that. He's a prophet. He's an oracle. He's something else. Sarah McLachlan, in my experience of her and her fans and her, you know, the websites about her and all that, I think she, many people feel the same way about her, that there was just something of oracular force about the music that she made, that it was so clear-eyed and so uplifting somehow and so penetrating and so pure in its vision that she had tapped into something that not much pop music ever had the chance to tap into. But again, these are difficult things to put a finger on. We're listening to this song because it's about redemption, because it speaks not from a Christian standpoint, but in very frank ways about just what it is to think about the possibility of innocence reborn. And I think that what I will do in this case is just play the song, see what you all have to make of it. As we make our way through it, I invite you not only to ponder the words. I have to say, I don't think she's a Bruce Springsteen-level poet. I don't think she's an Elvis Costello-level poet. I'm not sure we're dealing here with a masterful poet. And when it comes to Springsteen, when it comes to Elvis Costello, I feel confident treating these people like James Joyce, which is to say, any little interpretive niche you can find, any place you want to sort of stick in a crowbar and work in the interpretive stuff, is okay. That these people are working that hard at their craft. In this case, I'm not sure. I'm not sure just sort of how rich the ground really is for reading. So don't get lost trying to make sense of every tweak of the lyrics. Take in the music as well and ask, why does the music invite us to place such confidence in it? Why does she seem to speak with such moral authority? Because she has attained here a condition that I think many singers, many female singers in particular, aspire to, which is that just clear-eyed purity of the Joan Baez, of the Judy Collins, of the whatever, where you listen to this person sing and you think, that's it. We've just got sort of a conduit to truth, a conduit to grace right here. And how does she do it? How does this song work?
So hard to love you in my way.
What do you get out of this song? You can start anywhere you want.
Well, I think it's quite remarkable the way she, in her music and her words, she brings out this feeling of longing for what, how she's going to cope with what has happened.
Great. What has happened? What are you talking about?
I don't know.
I don't either.
We can guess.
Right.
Well, you don't know.
Yeah. Is it an unrequited love? The second verse talking about, I leave you with your misery, the friend who won't betray. So somebody who doesn't love themselves very much, and she tried to show that person how beautiful they were, and has had to move on from the sounds of it.
That's a very nice thought.
Well, I know I can't change the way you feel, the speaker says. But then the speaker also says, I do believe I failed you. I know I let you down. I mean, there's some ambiguity there. But I can't change the way you feel. Generally, it makes it sound like the other person no longer feels. Well, not necessarily, I guess.
Well, it says right there, Adion, I'm empty since you left me.
Right.
It says that, but it also says, I leave you with your misery. So it says I left
you,
it says you left me.
Well, no, I leave you because you're not feeling better. You're not feeling, you're not willing to let go of your grief.
You know, when I read these words and listened to the song, it reminded me of a friend of mine who died of chronic alcoholism. It had nothing to do with a loving relationship. It had something to do for me personally with how I personally have felt like I let this person down, and trying to help her with her issues. So that's just my take on it. I don't think it's necessarily a relationship, that kind of relationship issue.
Yeah. And I don't think it is either. I don't have the right answer about any of this stuff. I'm just right in there with everybody else, trying to make sense of these words. Sarah McLachlan, like most artists, is not all that helpful when it comes to these things. There were rumors for a while that this referred, that Adia was in fact a friend of hers who had suffered sexual abuse as a child, and was sort of working through this, and that this is a song about somehow speaking of that. I have never found Sarah McLachlan saying anything to sort of back up that stance. But
when it came out, she said it was written, Adia was her aunt.
And the name had been changed. What was the name originally? It was going to be. There was a different name with which she had sort of crafted the song. I do know this story, but I've no. Well, or this report from her. But there are several other things that she said that. Well, we don't have to get into. Do you want to say more about her aunt's story? That, I mean, is there any
That's
good reason
all I
this
remember
is?
That.
Yeah. Well, shoot. What is the name? She had been crafting another, working with another name when she started the song, but then it was too much like another song, and I can't remember what it is. Mm-hmm. Of course, when Paul McCartney started writing Yesterday, the syllables he used to craft this melody, as he worked it through, was scrambled eggs that we had. I mean, sort of early, I mean, that's what he was kind of workshopping with, was scrambled eggs. And then he realized Yesterday was going to have to be it. So goodness knows sort of where in the process, if a name comes from an aunt, if a whole sort of framework of experience comes from a friend, goodness knows where pop songs come from, and you know what finally they can be said to mean. And perhaps there's a romantic relationship gone bad at work here.
Does ADA have something to do with addiction? Just as a word, did it stumble out that way?
I don't know. That's a nice thought.
The word, I don't know, blame just seems to be kind of like migrating through this whole song. It starts out blaming herself, and then it's like, but we're all innocent, and so no one's to blame. But then, really, I gave you everything, and you don't want it, so you know, kind of like this indirect, you're to blame. And I'll just leave you with your misery. I pulled you from your tower. I take away your pain. I'm kind of putting myself, it's just kind of like this modulating all over the place. That's what it kind of turned it for me on. At the end of it, I just felt completely baffled. Like, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
And it's nobody's fault. I'm innocent. It ain't my fault.
Mm-hmm. Kind of a pointless journey.
But if it's about sexual abuse, if a child is sexually abused, they are innocent. It is not their fault. They shouldn't carry that shame. But they do into their adulthood. And some women, or men too, but they can't get over the shame of it all. Then they think that, especially if they're not a good therapist, they think that they could have done something to change their, why it happened to them. They could have fought it off. And so sexual abuse is extremely complicated, and the scars it leaves behind are powerful. And sometimes, unless you have a very good therapist, you're never going to recover.
Now, I must ask you all, is what we're doing right now, first of all, this is the first thing I do when I confront a pop song, is try to figure out what the heck it's about. I mean, what is the song trying to tell me? And in the case, some of you were around to talk about Elvis Costello's Favorite Hour. It took many listenings before I came around to realizing, Favorite Hour is about hanging. But if you don't walk into it knowing that, trust me, a perfectly intelligent person can listen to that song a lot of times and not turn that key, not figure out that that's what all of these images are pointing to. I don't know, maybe I'm overestimating my own intellectual capacities, and it's possible that none of you would have been fooled, but I couldn't make heads or tails of that song until I finally turned the key. And perhaps that's our task here, is to sort of find that key. What is this song finally about? But if we act for a moment as though that is not our task, that is, perhaps it's, this is a song that is about sexual abuse. Perhaps this can be a song that, that we, if we have an experience of someone suffering from addiction, from, say, chronic alcoholism, perhaps this song will find a home in that experience of ours, and that we will, hear the song with those ears. Perhaps the song is indeed about a relationship somehow. But setting aside those questions for the moment, what can we say about her authority? What can we say about the grounds on which to say that, we're born innocent? Believe me, we are still innocent. I mean, these are pretty big claims. We might take them from Jesus, for example. If Jesus came up to us and said such things to us, that you still are innocent, you will be reborn, whatever. Why would we take it from Sarah McLachlan? I mean, what can we say about this music that makes it work, that makes us, want to believe, that draws us in? How does this music operate?
For me, it didn't draw me in. It seemed like that the prose was written and then the music was forced to fit it and it didn't quite make it. That's what I felt out of it.
Very interesting. Can you say more about what you feel?
I don't know, because there are places where, well, like in the chorus where you have the two first lines where you have four syllables or whatever syllables it is, the second line, innocent is a word that's thrown at the end of the sentence, so it's forced to be totally out of style as the first line. Didn't work, and then the music was forced to fit the words, and that didn't really work, and I found that the music kind of just was all over the place. There wasn't any continuity from the beginning to the end with the music.
That's a very interesting observation.
I'm not degrading it, but it's partly feel-good music.
Yeah.
It wasn't played on the same radio station that the other side of the page is on. I think rock music at some, or the other sheet of paper. Or the other side of the paper. But at some point, rock music, it started going into different audiences. This was a soft rock station song. And it's nice to listen to. You can listen to the words if you want to. You don't have to listen to the words. It's pretty. It makes you feel good. And if you read what it says, yes, it says some very powerful things, but you don't have to enjoy it. You don't have to listen to you don't even have to read the words, know the words.
I don't know this. I hadn't heard this really before, but it's a woman's song.
It is.
I think we have to take that into account.
Right.
It's definitely a woman's. I play this in my shop, and women just calm down when they
Well, I guess because I'm a good woman, I feel like this has an overall human interest in it, that we have all experienced these same emotions, and from that aspect, she has credence.
Very good. But I'm not going to let you off that easy. What emotions? I mean, in general, what emotion is this song about, do you think?
Well, the feeling that I haven't been able to do enough, the feeling of loss, mm-hmm. and wishing for more.
Okay. Terrific.
I had two thoughts. My first one, you were asking about the music itself, and I was thinking you could almost take out her voice and substitute kind of a breathy flute mm-hmm. and have almost the same song.
Yeah.
And it'd still be very nice to listen to.
Yeah.
But then you were asking about what makes, you know, why does she have that element of truth to it? And the one that kind of struck me, and again, this is from a woman's perspective, because I think that's why it appeals, is that show you the beauty you possess because you don't believe it. Virtually no women believe that they're beautiful.
Right.
And we all want somebody to see that and tell us.
Yeah.
Because we don't see it for ourselves.
Right. And I think you all are right. I mean, this feels, even to me, like a woman's song to the core. And I'm sort of, I'm invited to eavesdrop on this song. I'm invited to buy the record too, but I'm an eavesdropper. Yeah.
I was thinking it also talking about guilt.
Okay.
Guilt. Don't feel guilty.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Fascinating stuff. Now, why a woman's song? When we confronted Joan Osborne, this is not a strand I thought we were going to be teasing out, but we must. Some of you have been around all week and you've heard us play Joan Osborne's One of Us. I'm not talking about the authorial we. You know, we as a group encountered Joan Osborne's One of Us. And you remember the chord progression to that song that I said is a chord progression that has blogs about it, that has, you know, a Boston Globe article about it. This chord progression, moving from here to here to here, finally. And we noticed this in Adia. This is it. And what this journalist, whose name is escaping me, Mark, I can't remember his name. What this journalist is pointing out is this is the sensitive woman progression. This is what goes. And what if God was one of us? It goes. I'm changing keys for a purpose here, but. But this is, of course, the progression we have in Adia. Adia, I thought that we could make it. And it doesn't go here. But those of us who know this album, although the biggest hit on the album was Building a Mystery, the Sarah McLachlan album. With the same chord progression. And one of the other big hits on the album was Sweet Surrender. Doesn't mean much. Doesn't mean anything at all. I've left behind me. And it goes on. Sarah McLachlan, three major hits on the album, all actually sort of use that same chord progression. And the same chord progression that we hear in What If God Was One of Us. Where else do we hear it? Mm-hmm. Well, we heard it yesterday. Let's see. Promise me that you'll give faith a fighting chance. And when you get the choice to sit it out or dance, I hope you dance. I hope you dance. And it goes on from there. That is the chord progression of I Hope You Dance. This is a chord progression that we've been sort of living with for, well, for years now. The sensitive woman chord progression. I don't know if it's disparaging. Yes, I do. It is disparaging to speak of it thus. But still, there's this power in this chord progression I don't know, it does something to us. It makes you feel like something profound is going on. Is that a thought?
Getting rid of a bug.
Oh. Who knows, the whole week may feel that way to all of us, but we'll, now, what you said a few moments ago made me think you're not buying it, that somehow she wants answers that are too easy, that she just wants to be absolved of all this, not have to think too hard.
Well, maybe I'll tell you.
Well,
it was interesting when hearing what the validity, what the connection was. Nobody talked about it's easy, we falter, doesn't matter. That's her final word.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody seem to respond to that.
You mean none of us?
Yeah.
Okay, well, do you want to respond to it? What do you
I'm wondering, what does it mean? Is it a suitable answer? It seems to be your answer.
And Doug, is that where you were going
to
go?
It is. I had the same question as to how people responded when we get to what is the chorus, and clearly her punchline in the sense, because we are, it was for me, it was because we are born innocent. We are born innocent. And I just wondered what people's response to that was. Did you buy it when you hit that point that she sold you?
Doctrinal problems with that line.
Well, say more.
I bought into original sin a while back. Yeah. We aren't born innocent.
Okay.
We are born beloved.
Isn't the message one of forgiveness when you use the word innocent? That's what strikes me. It's all about forgiveness.
Okay.
There's a pureness to innocence that does exist for God's children.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
But there was real hurt. I mean, we heard that. We talked about it could be addiction. It could be betrayal. It could be abuse. And then just to say, I mean, for a victim to hear, you are innocent, but how does that apply to the abuser?
I think those people have got that feeling, I'm not quite good enough.
Yeah.
You know, that we all have. You know, I'm not quite good enough. I should have done something else.
Yeah. Yep. Great. Other thoughts?
Because I speak from abuse issues, and the message that the abuse was physical, and I never forgot it like a lot of people do, but the messages I got were what dominated my life. The messages were, I wasn't good enough, I'm not nice enough, if I was only nicer, bad things wouldn't happen.
Right.
And so you get these really under self-esteem issues from it, because you're not good enough, so bad things happen to you.
Yeah.
And that's the message you get from abuse. So it took someone to say, it wasn't your fault. You were blameless. You did not invite this on to you as a five-year-old. You know, so it's really powerful to have someone say, you are beautiful, you are innocent, it wasn't your fault. You can have a better life. And if you don't believe that for yourself, you're going to stay stuck as a victim. And you are not going to have victory in your life if you stay stuck. So these are really powerful words from that context, if that's what you want to believe. You have, I don't know, a lot of people turn to addiction because of childhood issues, and they never explore it. And as someone who's trying to help them live in victory, when they can't do it, because they don't believe the promises of God, they don't believe grace applies to their life, it's very frustrating.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You feel like you failed them. So this would be interesting to have her in the room and pick her apart and say, But music should be an invitation to evaluate your own life.
Excellent. Thank you.
I'm curious about the word tower. Pull you from your tower. What does this bring to mind? What is your tower?
It's your burden. It might be your burden. Your prison, your hurt, your isolation.
I flashed on Rapunzel on that.
Well, I did too.
I did, but I'll deal with her. You know, trying to get out.
I was thinking it could be a cocoon where you walled yourself off.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could be like being in the depths.
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean, honing in on that word. And to me, this kind of word is where pop music is absolutely at its best. And I guess one thing I wanted to sort of hold up and cherish about this song is that I do have a sneaking suspicion that if you are somebody who walked in the room today, fresh out of a relationship gone bad, in which you tried and tried and tried to make a romantic relationship work out, and it didn't, the person just didn't love you back, or whatever, that this song might be deeply nourishing. I mean, this song might be deeply helpful in that regard. If you're someone who has dealt with a situation of chronic addiction, of chronic alcoholism, the song could be nourishing in the same way. If you are somebody who has personally experienced childhood abuse, or has a close friend who has, this song could be nourishing in that way. And it has always struck me that this is where pop music is at its best, is in being polyvalent, in being able to speak in different ways, in just this way, and that we find this ability nowhere more powerfully than in things like tower. What the heck is the tower? I mean, to pull you from your tower, this could mean, I'm not going to say it could mean anything, but it could mean a lot of things. That could be a lot of towers. And so we decide what the tower is. And this really was the lesson that Bob Dylan taught us in the 60s as a pop music composer, as a folk singer, who made everything seem so profound. And how did he make it seem profound? Well, much of it had to do with using very few words that seemed like they could mean a lot of things. I mean, in the last verse of All Along the Watchtower, outside in the cold distance, a wild cat did growl. Two riders were approaching, and the wind began to howl. And you think, oh my gosh, that is something really important he's talking about. I have no idea what it is. Who knows who the riders are? Who knows what the wind is? I mean, you can make that be about anything you want, but, it just sort of sits there with this power, all this sort of kinetic, or this sort of potential, energy in it, waiting to be sort of drawn out via whatever interpretation you bring. I'm delighted that we got to the tower. Doug, I think you had your hand up a little bit ago. Was that...
Yeah, I think it can wait. No, it's just, I guess what I want to say, I'm responding in a way, if I had felt the song was about abuse, I mean, I would go exactly where you are. And I deal with college students, and I deal one-on-one very often with students who have been abused in all sorts of ways. And I will absolutely say to them, you are innocent.
Right.
But I didn't get that. That's not where I went with the song.
Right.
And so I'm not hearing it in that. That's what you're saying. I'm not hearing it in quite that same context.
Right.
And so when I got to, because we are born innocent, it wasn't simply a doctrinal issue for me. Mm-hmm. I just, the song hadn't brought me along to the point where I could accept that really huge statement.
Mm-hmm.
It felt more naive than like a genuine truth. Probably because I wasn't quite in that context.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think it sounded that way to several of us. And to me, this will probably be the last thing I say before we break up for the day. But I think finally, this is how pop music always works. I mean, is pop music great art the way the Brothers Karamazov is great art? And the answer is, well, very rarely, probably never. I mean, that is, the pop song is just too narrow a thing to accommodate what can be accomplished in a massive Russian novel like the Brothers Karamazov. But it can accomplish little things, and it can accomplish them very well. But in a certain sense, it only accomplishes those things for those who believe. That is, if you are willing to subscribe, to say, I am going to permit the ascription of meaning, I am going to bring this to it or that to it, I am going to spend the time, and I'm going to draw these things out. That pop music, very good pop music, and it's not all good, but very good pop music is, to my mind, just immeasurably rich. And I think I will close just by saying I very much appreciated all of you who brought your voices and just your presence to this conversation in the course of this week. It's been, to me, a very stimulating series of conversations, and I hope there's been some stimulation there for you all as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.